Hello and welcome to this episode of the Global Innovators in Business series. In the series, we bring leaders and innovators from different fields, share their experiences and advice with undergraduate students to write inspiration and motivation during the pandemic. We're so happy to have with us Daniel Yu. Daniel is the founder and CEO of Wasoko. Wasoko has been able to partner, help, supply, and support the financing of informal retail shops across Africa. He's also conversational in 8 languages and took the founder's pledge to transfer 70% of his proceeds to effective interventions reducing suffering. Thank you so much for being here, Daniel.
Pleasure to be here.
So to start off the journey, I'm half Chinese, quarter American, and quarter Japanese. So coming out from this background, I'm really interested, growing up in a multicultural family with different backgrounds, different perspectives, how did that influence and shape your upbringing?
Great question. I think it's actually been pivotal to my entire journey. I, as you mentioned, grew up in a multicultural household. My father is Hong Kong Chinese. My mother is from Peoria, Illinois, third generation German American. So definitely very different worlds that they grew up in and ultimately brought together in raising a family in California, which is where I was born and raised. What I'd say is that I definitely always had that appreciation from a young age that the world was much bigger than just the small suburb where I grew up. And so I think that kind of wider awareness that the way that things were done in my hometown of Camarillo, California, is not necessarily representative of the rest of the world. And that there are very interesting things about the rest of the world as well that you can go out there and explore and discover for yourself. And I think that whole mindset, even growing up at a young age, my parents always encouraged us to explore these different cultures. They took us to different places, encouraged us to study these different languages. I had the distinct pleasure, as I remember at the time, of being forced to go to both Chinese school on Friday nights and German school on Saturday mornings, which you can imagine as a 7-year-old was the last thing that I wanted to be doing with my time. That, however, though I think those classes themselves taught me little to nothing of the languages, I think the general kind of cultural value of valuing the diversity of the world and its different people and languages and everything else definitely stuck with me.
So interesting. And you ended up learning both German and Chinese through those.
What I'd say is my Chinese is quite solid, but my German is nicht gut. I would say German is not one of the ones that I typically count myself as being able to have a conversation. And I can do very basic things in German, but I would not claim otherwise that my German is anywhere close to most of the other languages that I speak.
And what propelled you to learn all of them?
I would say that a lot of it, and most of them, I would say apart from Mandarin and Spanish to some degree, the other languages that I learned as an adult, and those have really come about through the direct exposure and work that I've done over the past 10 years or so. So if I look at the other languages that I've learned, so Arabic, I actually did study for a year and a half in school. I had the opportunity to live in the Middle East for a few months. And that is actually even where the original idea behind the company that became Wasoko came from. And then I also learned Portuguese during a few months as part of this incubator accelerator program in Brazil that I applied to in the very early days of the company as well. And so that was a real immersion environment that got me quickly going there. Obviously, it was helpful that I already knew Spanish. I then learned Swahili after I moved over to East Africa. And that was very helpful, obviously, in terms of being able to talk to our customers and also demonstrate kind of a real dedication to the culture and understanding the local people and mindset. I also then picked up French. That was actually over the pandemic that I really put an effort in there. And that was mainly in anticipation for expansion to some Francophone markets that we're now active in as well. So yeah, that's been my journey with languages.
That's so interesting. Okay. So I think you mentioned and you hinted at the idea kind of originated in Egypt and in that region of the world. And I think in your life, you've moved from place to place. I think, how have you saw your life trajectory from a very young age? Did you know that's your focus would be on development in developing countries, or was that something that grew as you got to understand the different local markets and understand that perspective?
Good question. I would say that I definitely did not have a clear sense of what I'd be doing. Even right now, I there's a lot of lack of clarity on what I should be doing, sometimes even on a day-to-day basis. I guess that's part of being a startup CEO at times. It's figuring out what to actually do, what to focus on, what not to focus on is very key. But even if I go back, if you had asked me at age 10, age 15. So I think at age 10, I don't know, I probably would have said something like, I want to be a doctor. And that is probably the result of coming from a extremely healthcare focused family, just to give a sense. So my father is a physician, my mother is a pharmacist, my sister is now a doctor, and my youngest sister is becoming a dentist. So you have four healthcare professionals and then one college dropout who moved to Africa to start a tech company. Pick the odd one out. But for myself, I think even you go forward, like age 15, at age 15, I was very seriously studying music. In fact, I applied to universities as a music major, which is a kind of a very strange thing to do in retrospect, but that is what I was focused on at the time. Interestingly, between the time when I applied to universities as a music major and when I heard back 6 months later, or whatever the gap is, I'd actually gone through an existential crisis as a 17-year-old and realized that I didn't actually want to pursue music professionally for my life. So that was very interesting. But I would say maybe at that point, I realized that, okay, I feel like I could do more, something that is like more impactful, more actually beneficial for society, whatever that means. Not to say that music isn't an amazing gift of humanity and isn't something that billions of people enjoy, but I think for myself, or whatever perspective I had as a 17-year-old going through an existential crisis at the time, I had this feeling that, hey, there is something bigger that I can potentially do here. And what that was, I definitely had no clue at the time, but it put me on this kind of more open path of just saying, huh, no clue what I want to do. Let's get into it. I'm off to college now and let's explore and figure things out. So I think that was definitely the mindset in which I entered my undergrad. And the majors that I pursued at the time were actually very initially, I mapped it all out and realized that I should be able to do a triple major if I was strategic with overlapping all of my classes. So I think in my first year, I mapped it out. So yes, I was going to be a triple major between economics, international relations, and Near Eastern languages. That was what I was going after. So I set off on that kind of course of studies, strategically picking classes that would count towards multiple majors. And that was when I was studying Arabic too. And then I did a study abroad program in the Middle East, in Jordan and Egypt that summer. And that was when I got exposed to the concept or to the environment that inspired the company that ultimately became Wasoko.
Mm-hmm. Okay, there's one question I think. Actually, don't think I've ever asked, but I think in this situation, it's very interesting. I think to take a jump, a leap of faith into a different place, one of the biggest hurdles is you have to convince your parents or convince your family that this is an okay decision. When your entire family is doctors and physicians and pharmacists, how do you approach the conversation of, oh, I want to go to drive impact in a developing country?
That's a great question. We're skipping ahead a little bit. I don't know how much time we have. We probably don't have time to go through every play-by-play of the past 10 years. But basically, after getting this idea for this company or for this, let's call it a social enterprise at the time, because it definitely was even more, I'd say, just purely kind of impact-driven. I definitely didn't have a full business plan or everything mapped out at the time. But that concept after applying for this social enterprise business plan competition that my school ran every year, we ended up getting a prize and some funding for the idea. And that was the point at which I realized that actually the time and the energy that I'd been spending trying to figure out this business, this concept, was a lot more educational and enjoyable than the time that I'd been spending in my classes. And that was like quite apparent to me. And hey, I got this validation, this external validation from whatever, University of Chicago, Booth Business School, esteemed panel of judges and professors that seemed to think that this was a pretty cool idea and gave me whatever, $10,000 to do something about it. And I use that as the basic validation to go to my parents, specifically my dad, and say, look, I think there's something highly educational and potentially rewarding to be done here. I propose taking a leave of absence for a short period of time. And I laid out, I had extensively researched the university's leave of absence policy, which, shout out to the University of Chicago, is actually extremely flexible. So you can basically take a pause at any time. And whenever you want to come back, they let you re-register for classes, and it's no big deal. So it's not, oh, if you step away, then it's really difficult to come back in, or so they're very flexible. So I think it was I was able to pitch it to my dad as a kind of very low risk kind of thing to do, to spend a few more months exploring this kind of concept. I'd be self-sufficient in terms of, I had some funding. I'm also a software developer. I'm a coder as well. And so I was able to find like freelance projects to build people random websites and make money to support myself. And yeah, I just get the freedom, get the flexibility to actually try out this thing and see how far it would go. And that's basically how that journey got started, was taking that leave of absence from school and then saying, okay, let's see what we can do with this concept. And then just kept pulling on that thread for month by month, eventually year by year, until suddenly things started to really wind up and get going quite quickly. So that's how things came together.
That's so interesting. I think that conversation is very crucial to understand, and to have like validation and backing is very helpful in building that argument. So what was the idea, and how did you first get acquainted with this problem?
Yes, as I mentioned, I was in Egypt specifically, and I got to know some of these shopkeepers who were operating in the area where I was staying. And I realized that they had this big challenge around when they ran out of goods, like specific products, they would actually have to leave themselves and go all the way to some downtown wholesale market and buy more goods there, and then also transport the products back to the shop themselves. And so that kind of wastes a lot of time. The shop is closed down for half a day while they're doing all that. And all that just seemed like a very inefficient process, and something that also affects them. It increases their costs, makes it more difficult for them to run a business, as well as also affects the surrounding community. Because you want to get something, you go to the shop, it's closed. That's a unfortunate situation. The idea was, okay, can we connect the shopkeeper to suppliers? So this would be like a Procter & Gamble or Unilever, whoever is making the rice, the soap, the toilet paper that the shop needs. Can we connect them via a basic ordering platform? Originally, it was more SMS-based. Since then, we've migrated over to full smartphone apps. But yeah, that was the idea, is let's just have an ordering platform that can connect the shop to the supplier. And by doing that, presumably we could help eliminate this kind of need to shut down the store and run around and get the goods themselves, and digitize the shop and the process and bring them more into the kind of modern age of e-commerce and all that.
I see. So until this point, they would go to, if I was a small store owner in Africa, in Kenya, I would go to a store and purchase everything from like the goods of Coca-Cola to like soap to like small household necessities. And then you would go to a store and you replenish your store, and then different people will come to your store to buy individual items, correct?
Yeah, if you think about it in terms of, take like a New York bodega, right? So imagine that you're like a bodega shop in Queens or something like that in New York, right? So you're on a street corner and you sell soap and chips and Coca-Cola and whatever to people in the neighborhood. And when you run out of Coca-Cola or you run out of toilet paper, instead of there being like a truck that comes by every morning to restock your shelves, which is what happens in the US and New York and all these places, like you would then have to go to downtown Manhattan, arrange your own transport. Like you'd have to hire your own truck from somewhere, drive down into downtown Manhattan, and run around probably to several kind of like dingy Costco's and then like at the dingy Costco, buy the bulk toilet paper and like chips and soap, Coca-Cola, whatever you need, load up the truck, and then drive it back to your bodega shop way out in Queens or wherever you are. That is the default state of affairs for most mom and pop shopkeepers in Africa right now. There's nobody who is delivering the stuff to them. They have to go get it from these kind of central wholesale points across these different African cities. And so you could see in that example why that would be like very taxing on the shopkeeper, because it is a huge, not only waste of time, but also increased cost having to hire the truck. And then you're losing sales too, because like you're out in the store for, you know, probably at least 3-4 hours doing that whole sourcing run. So that's really the pain point that we're solving for all these shops across the different markets that we're in Africa.
So interesting. And you provided internet or like internet-based like digital alternative that can help them fulfill those needs and help.
Yeah, basically now with Wasoko, this shopkeeper, instead of having to go rent out their own truck to drive to downtown wherever, they can just open the app and place an order for 2 boxes of soap and 5 rolls of toilet paper and 10 cases of Coca-Cola or whatever it is that they need. And then we, on our side, we'll then do free same-day delivery to restock their store. So on our side, we basically we're working with all these manufacturers. So we work with Coca-Cola, with Unilever, Procter & Gamble, all these companies, but majority local companies actually. And basically, we have listed their products on our platform and pre-positioned those products into our warehouses. So we have a mega fulfillment center that we've set up strategically across the different cities where we operate. And we're basically getting all of these orders coming in real time and using that to then design delivery routes so that we can then fill up a big truck to then go out and actually deliver shop by shop and do that delivery on average in 4 or 5 hours. So you can have a shop that places their order at 8 a.m. and they're going to get that delivered to them by noon. And they don't have to shut down their store, go run around. They can rely on the fact that Wasoko is bringing them what they need. And as a result, keep serving the community without interruption.
Interesting. What type of problems that are unique to developing country that we had to face that probably if this would have happened in a developed world would have never come up?
Yeah. Yeah. So I think the biggest difference on our side was the need to actually build out that logistics and delivery network ourselves. So unlike in the US, if you look at e-commerce companies, pretty much every e-commerce company that's ever been built in the US has done so by using existing logistics providers, right? Amazon got started by using UPS and FedEx and whoever to do their home delivery of books. Amazon did not go out there and be like, oh, we have to build our own United States Postal Service, the Postal Service of Amazon, to deliver books to every home in America. They were able to use these existing logistics players to do that. In our countries, so everywhere we work, there is no postal service, at least none that exists in any kind of functional form. There is no kind of UPS. There are no address systems. So there is no kind of home address where you can just punch it in and find it on a map and everybody knows it. That doesn't exist. This was a kind of very unique challenge that early on we had to really get into, which is, okay, there are millions of these mom and pop stores out there across Africa, and nobody has mapped them out. So there's nobody actually really knows where each one of them is. And there is no logistics network that exists to reliably deliver to them. So we ended up, actually the kind of first pivot that we did as a business or expansion really was then saying, okay, the system itself is not enough. Just having an ordering system platform is not sufficient. We actually have to figure out how to solve this logistics problem as well in an integrated way with the platform that we have. So that's really where we then had the take several years to basically figure out and set up this last mile delivery logistics network to figure out how to do delivery to all of these bodegas across the country. That involved like mapping them out. So actually having sales agents, like field representatives who would go to the shop and actually capture the PIN, the latitude, longitude of where's the store, verify, okay, this is where the Mama Kenya shop is in this neighborhood. Okay, that's confirmed. and then figure out how do you actually set up a whole fleet of truck drivers or whatever that are going to be able to actually do deliveries, like using an app-based system. There was nobody in our markets was using turn-by-turn navigation. You know, Google Maps was not really working in a kind of turn-by-turn navigation kind of way back then. So we had to figure out how to do that. We also figure out how to run a warehouse, build out the technology to track all that stuff. And there was a lot. There was a lot that we were doing over those years, which is, I think, why it took us a little while to get to the point where we started really taking off. But yeah, a lot of hard work back in those days.
And why did you choose APCA as your starting place?
The interesting thing is it came really more from a pull perspective. I mentioned having this original idea in Egypt. And then I was back in Chicago, entered the business plan competition, won a prize of funding, then dropped out and kept working on this concept. And really what I was doing at that time was building out a prototype of the technology. So it's this like ordering platform where I do a demo and kind of show people how the ordering would work. And so that system, basically what I did was I sent out a bunch of cold emails to all of these different representatives of the big consumer goods companies across all of their local country offices. So I was messaging the Procter & Gamble office in Mexico, Brazil, India, Egypt, Kenya, and I think a number of other countries as well. And it just so happened that the people that I was messaging in Kenya consistently were the most excited about this idea, this concept, what we were doing. And in retrospect, at the time, I just thought that, huh, okay, this is interesting. Kenyans seem to be like really excited about this stuff. But in retrospect, what I think was happening is absolutely the fact that M-Pesa, which I think you had some firsthand experience with when you were visiting recently, is this kind of fantastic near universal mobile money system that exists in Kenya. And even back in those days, we're talking 8 years ago, was already very firmly established and everybody was using. And so I think from the suppliers, these manufacturers perspective in Kenya, the idea of implementing a mobile ordering system made a lot of sense given that mobile money was already very established as well.
Interesting. So it definitely helps have an infrastructure built in place to help support these advancements and growth. Is there the same type of mobile money system in the other countries that you're operating? Also, could you list the places that you're operating currently?
Yes. So we currently operate in Kenya, Tanzania, Rwanda, Uganda, and Zambia. And to answer that question on the mobile money systems, yes, mobile money does exist in all of the other countries apart from just Kenya. However, they are not as universal as they are in Kenya, and the market is a lot more fragmented and competitive. So unlike in Kenya, M-Pesa has 99% market share when it comes to mobile money. In Tanzania, for example, you have really a 3-4-way split between Airtel Money, Tigo Pesa, Vodacom M-Pesa. Yeah, it's a much more kind of dynamic market in that sense. And it's meant that you don't have that kind of one system that everybody uses, which I think has inhibited the adoption to some extent as well.
Interesting. So what do you see as the difference between driving impact in developing countries using a business model versus using a nonprofit model?
Great question. I think that there are definitely spaces for both. However, I do think that business in developing markets is a highly underrated focus area for driving impact, in the sense that if we really break this down to first principles, in terms of you have these countries that have very low incomes on average, people who are in, by any kind of global North standard, in dire conditions of poverty. And if we actually break down and we think through what is going on here, like why are people fundamentally poor? And you can point at things like people didn't have the opportunity to get good education. There are challenges with healthcare. There are challenges with infrastructure. Pretty much everything that you point to ultimately comes back to the fact that people don't have the resources to invest in all of these things to improve their livelihoods. And it's not like people don't want to, right? Obviously, you look at the households spend on things like education, healthcare, it's much higher even than it is in the US. Obviously, fewer dollars because it's a much lower average income in Africa is $3 a day. And the proportion that people are spending on these services to try to better their lives is much, much higher proportionally than it would be in the US, for example. But fundamentally, the problem here is that we don't have quality jobs that are providing high enough incomes for these individuals. And it comes back to there's a lot of great economists out there that have really written about this. Lat Pritchett, I think, is the kind of star in a lot of this stuff, where there's a reason why people don't die from malaria in Singapore versus there are still millions of people who die from malaria in Nigeria. And even though they have more or less the same climates, they're both like very hot and humid places. 60, 70 years ago, there were people who were dying from malaria in Singapore because at the time, Singapore was as poor per capita as most places in Africa. But they managed to get on the income development ladder in terms of, and Singapore's political economy and history is very unique in terms of what Lee Kuan Yew did and lots of things. I'm not saying that can be easily replicated in most other places. But the point being that they didn't solve poverty and death from preventable illnesses just by handing out mosquito nets or by starting nonprofits that were addressing the symptoms of poverty. They solved the overall situation by tackling the root of poverty, which by definition is providing people with opportunities to generate a higher income. And I think that's something that I've really crystallized a lot more as I've gotten further along in this journey, which is that fundamentally what we need to figure out how to do is create hundreds of millions and eventually billions of proper jobs that are going to enable people to lift themselves out of poverty and actually afford and fund through taxes and all the other revenue generating services that governments need to provide effective infrastructure and healthcare and education. We need to get to that level. And it starts by having productive enterprises that are actually generating surplus in the form of profits and revenues that can be taxed and can be paid out to workers in rising wages that are ultimately going to be needed to solve the core problems. So I think NGOs, nonprofits, we need them to deal with the emergency outcomes that are the symptoms of poverty today, people dying from preventable diseases and things like malaria. And yes, we should be handing out bed nets to solve that. But we also need to be tackling the root problem, which is that there are not enough jobs. There are not enough productive income generating jobs to lift people out of poverty. And at the end of the day, if we want to actually solve this in long term, that's really where we should be focusing our energy and frankly, our funds as well.
Really good perspective. I think once you align a business with a profits making motivation and you can align that with some problem they're trying to solve, then it's so much easier to scale because there's like a natural mechanism. People want to buy it and would be willing to spend more money to buy it than just like taking the product in. So like that gives a natural motivation to continue to drive progress.
And it's sustainable too, right? I'll give just an example, food for thought. I'm sure there's a lot of people listening to this who are familiar with universal basic income, which in general, I'm in full support of. I think that's if you're going to give out $8, I think universal basic income versus the vast majority of other things is far more effective. At the same time, if you had the choice between, okay, give someone $500 one time or invest $500 into a business that creates one or two jobs for people to then make $100 a month forever, like on an ongoing basis for years to come, like obviously you would choose the latter, right? Because that's actually creating, it's a self-sustaining enterprise, right? I don't know, you invest $500 and you make a basic, I don't know, a sewing shop out of your house or something like that. You're able to buy equipment. And then, yeah, you make $100, $200 a month for that out of the proceeds, the profits that you're able to generate from that. That is very clearly a much better return on investment than a one-time $500 giveaway to a family, right? I think it's about also thinking about the return on investment per dollar, right? Long-term, what we're trying to solve, as you said, is the kind of the root causes of poverty. And sure, you can do that by just like giving people more money, but fundamentally, you want that money to ultimately go towards initiatives that are going to become self-sustaining and generating their own money, which is what a good investment ultimately is. And I think there's a lot of things to like unpack. And there's a lot of times I think people talk past each other. These are like very different worlds too, the kind of like nonprofit world versus the kind of commercial private sector. I'm more and more of the belief that pretty much any business that you can create in the context of a low-income place, like most parts of Africa, that is not either like purely extractive or preying on addictive behaviors. If you were starting some kind of like online gambling type of thing, like I wouldn't be in support of that. But otherwise, like just a regular, like boring business. If you started a brick making factory, start a brick making factory and you employ 200 people that are just like making bricks, that is an enormous social impact. Like the social impact to employ 200 people and actually give them a stable monthly wage, monthly salary. The average Kenyan worker, I'll quote this Kenya, but I think it holds true for broadly everywhere else in Africa that I've seen. The average Kenyan worker has 8 dependents. When you have someone who actually has a stable income, has a stable job, you are directly supporting the lives of 8 other people along with that. So you basically multiply it by almost 10x the number of people that are being directly supported by a worker who actually has a job. You got those 200 people, like you are now catering for the lives of, you know, over 1500 people with the 200 people that you are employing at your brick factory. And you could be guaranteed that those are people, a good chunk of whom, probably, you know, close to half of whom are actually children who are now actually going to be able to go to school, who, if one of them has a health emergency, the hospital fees can hopefully be afforded. These are all things that ultimately having jobs that people can get regular incomes out of become transformative for the larger societal fabric. So I just think like people get very, when it comes to impact, people tend to think about it more in like a thematic lens. Like they're like, and to have an impact as a social enterprise, you must be working in healthcare or in education or in sustainable green solutions or something like that. And as I said, my time being out here and actually building up a business now to more than 1,000 employees has, I think, pretty clearly demonstrated to be like, no, like the most impactful thing that happens when you build out an organization is the direct employment that is generated. And I think to that extent, the more blue collar jobs that can be generated ultimately in terms of giving people incomes for opportunity who otherwise would most likely be unemployed or underemployed, that's really where there's an enormous impact to be had.
That's such a great point, and I agree 100%. And yeah, I just wanted to highlight that. How many mom and pop shops are you supporting now through Wasoko?
So over 50,000.
50,000, probably each one of them is like supporting their own families, so like the impact that Wasoko currently has, and also your own employees too. So there's one more question that we always ask is that, what is your advice to students who are like around 20 to 30 years old, who are looking to deliver impact in your career? What is your top advice for them?
My advice would be to keep pulling at your threads of interest. So reflecting on my story, I was initially just very curious to learn Arabic. And that's why I went to the Middle East and found myself there in a place that I otherwise wouldn't normally be. And while I was there, I became intrigued by this problem of small shopkeepers having to endure all of this hassle to go get their goods and think about, so maybe something else that I could do about that. And then that led to me entering this business plan competition. And then that led to actually getting the recognition and the prize. And then just kept pulling on it further, just saying, hey, how far can we take this? And being very open to running into dead ends, backing up, going the other way, just keep exploring these different pathways towards more and more interesting things. And I think that if you are really open to those pathways of exploration on things that you're genuinely interested in, that you are willing to work very hard at, and you just keep going with them, you will eventually find yourself in a very unique place that potentially very few other people have come across. And that's, I think, really where you can add tremendous value with your time, your energy, and ultimately your career. And so I think that's definitely the advice that I would have. Keep pulling on the strings of your life and follow your interests, work extremely hard at them. Don't be afraid to change if something seems to be a dead end, but just keep going and find other pathways for it.
I love that so much. Thank you, Daniel. That's such great advice. Yeah. I think so many students are very inspired by your story and how that process took place. And it's a really good role model. Ellen, I see you're online. Do we have a question?
Yes. My question is, as you are transforming communities, how can you ensure the efficiency of the work of so many places?
To ensure the efficiency of the process work.
Transform work, yeah.
Got it. So for us, we obviously are very focused internally on optimizing our different operations, especially the deliveries, the logistics. In e-commerce, the logistics cost is usually the biggest line item. And so you have to make sure that every order that you're delivering is still making a profit, right? And that's really, I think, where we have been very focused, especially the past few years, is how can we optimize and ensure that we're maximizing the number of deliveries per vehicle, that we're increasing the average order value of different shops. And so this is really what we do internally day by day, is we're looking at the metrics, we're looking at numbers, we're comparing city to city and saying, okay, in Nairobi, the average order value is not growing very much, but in Dar es Salaam, it's growing there. So what is working in Dar es Salaam that we can maybe apply over in Nairobi? It's constantly doing these comparisons across markets. And it's quite interesting. I think we've learned a lot in that process. And overall, we are seeing that growth and that improvement across the board. So I think that the team has been doing a good job with it as well.
Amazing. Thank you so much, Daniel, for taking this time, and really appreciate all of the advice and all of the lessons that you shared.